My dad is a Navy veteran, and he retired from the Navy after 24 years, I believe. And he, I was around the Navy my whole life. I mean, I was born in Norfolk, and so it was familiar, and didn't really know what I wanted to do after high school. And so I joined the Navy and spent 21 years in it.
So tell me about your dad. What wars did he serve in?
He was in during Vietnam, and he was in during the whole time from before it started until it was over. So he retired in 90, gosh, when did he retire? It was probably in the early 80s, late 70s. I don't recall. Okay. 79, 80, something like that. He okay. retired. So, and he was stationed at the Pentagon, so we lived at Bowling Air Force Base, and we lived on the bases the whole time I was growing up. So
it was natural that you just stay there.
Yeah, it was very familiar to me. So, yeah. And that's kind of, I think, why my son also joined the Navy. He is a Navy SEAL right now. He's stationed in Hawaii with a SEAL team over there, which is pretty impressive because the SEALs have about an 85% attrition rate, meaning that only about 15% of the people that go into the program actually complete it because it's so rough. So, but he completed it after a year of training and torture and a lot of pain, but he made it through, and he's in Hawaii right now. So
has he been to Iraq, or would he have to go to Iraq?
He may. Okay. He's in a training phase right now, so they don't actually have their schedule for, he was in Guam a few weeks ago supporting one of the operations over there. So they kind of, in the SEAL teams, they kind of deploy. Sometimes you don't even know where they're at. And a lot of times it's top secret. He can't tell us where he's going, how long he's going to be gone. We just have to, he'll call us when he gets back. So that part of it's a little bit scary. So I'm sure that he'll be in some dangerous places and situations, but he's had the best training possible. So we're pretty comfortable with that, knowing that anyway.
So. But it has to be extra scary for someone in your position because mm-hmm. you know so much about the military and how mm-hmm. how many things you could come across.
Sure, but you know, I think it's been a benefit for him because he's been encountered things like when I was a young sailor. I had gone in, it was several years after my dad retired, so he was kind of disconnected a little bit from what was going on in the Navy at that time, and the fact that I just retired, you know, basically a year before he went in, I'm still pretty familiar with a lot of that stuff. So he's able to kind of count on us for a lot of, you know, support and information, really, about how do I do this or how do I do that, or I'm frustrated with this, and we'll give him pointers on, well, you know, I think you need to go talk to your command master chief, or you need to go do this. And he pretty much listens to that, and it helps him. So that's good.
How old were you when your dad was then in Vietnam?
Well, when did Vietnam start?
65, kind of.
Well, I was born in 65. So
you were, okay. Yeah. I was just kind of curious, since we're talking about family, if you mm-hmm. remember anything about your dad coming back or mm-hmm. being over there? Or?
Well, I think he had orders to go to a riverboat in Vietnam, but he was, I don't know if, I think he might, he was in Norfolk. I don't know where he was stationed at the time, but he had the orders changed, so he didn't actually go to that riverboat over there, which is a good thing, I think, for us, because I now have two more sisters, so, because he came back, or didn't go, so,
right.
But I, you know, he was on ships all the time, so I do remember, you know, when he would leave for deployments, and now deployments are typically 6 months, but then typically it was 11, 12, sometimes 14-month deployments, so you didn't really know when they were coming back, but there was always that, you know, scene of standing on the pier waving goodbye and, you know, that whole thing. So, but I definitely, I don't know if my little sisters remember that, but I know my older sister does too.
So you have three sisters in total?
Mm-hmm. Four girls.
So to talk about your experience with mm-hmm. the Navy, tell me what your prime duties were and what you did with your time.
I was primarily in supply or logistics for the whole time I was in the Navy. So I was at various different commands, but at every command I did supply. So whether it was on a ship or, you know, for a squadron or for an explosive ordnance disposal unit or various different types of commands, I was in supply at each of those. So that was kind of, and so after doing that, when I retired in 2005, I actually work at the VA as the director of logistics there. So I do have a lot of experience in supply and logistics, and whether you're counting nuts and bolts or Band-Aids, you know, it's supply is supply. So, but it was, I did some DEA operations down in the Caribbean.
Tell me what that is.
That's drug interdiction operations. Oh, that okay. was back probably, when was that? I'm trying to think, about the early 90s, when that was kind of the big thing, and the unit that I was stationed with, we actually went down to the Caribbean to do some drug interdiction operations down there. So you think, you know, duty in the Caribbean, ooh, that's rough. But of course, you know, you still have the family separation that you have to deal with. So that's always rough. But so that was a lot of fun. And then when I was stationed on the USS Incheon, that was a lot of fun too. We got to go to the North Atlantic and the Mediterranean for a 4-month deployment. So got to see some countries over there and experience that.
And you enlisted in 84.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like joining up at that time? Because then you still had the factions fighting when it comes to communism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was it an interesting time to join? And correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, there weren't a lot of armed conflicts at that time.
No, there wasn't a lot of armed conflicts. And, you know, it was the Cold War. And later on, they did actually come out and award people that were in the service during that time, because there was no actual conflict going on, but they did award the National Defense Medal to people that were in during what they called the Cold War, because even though we didn't have an actual conflict to go to, you know, you still had the training, and you still had, you know, you train like you fight. So, you know, it's not like you're just pretending to do it. You were actually out there doing it, whether it was doing a drug interdiction operation or out on a ship on a deployment or flying the planes or whatever it was. You still had to actually perform like you were in a war, so because you train like you fight. So it was, you know, I can't say that I actually was on the ground in any particular situation, but in the Navy, a lot of the times you're not on the ground. You're on a ship, and you know, you're out in the ocean, and you're still involved, but you don't feel that direct involvement because you're not actually down there on the ground. So it was interesting. It was, you know, the early 80s. You still had there wasn't a lot of women in the Navy at that time, and there's more now, but not as much as some of the other services. And so you had the issues that went along with that, as far as some of the sexual harassment and fraternization issues, and had to deal with that, and just the thought process of some of the people that women just can't do certain things, which they got proved wrong in a lot of things. But there's still a few things that they can't do. They can't go into the Navy SEALs. That is definitely one thing that they cannot do in the Navy. But for the most part, they have opened up a lot of the fields so that the women can do any of that stuff. So
help me understand how you were treated. I mean, can you give me some specific examples as mm-hmm. a woman where there was that sexism and mm-hmm. genderism, I guess you could say?
Well, you would get assigned the typical duties that the stereotype of a woman would get assigned. Make the coffee, type the letters, you know, make the conference room reservations, things like that. You know, that would, even if you were on the same pay grade and in the same job as a male counterpart, you would always get those tasks because you're a woman and you're supposed to know how to do that kind of stuff. And so those kinds of things, until they realized or you were strong enough to stand up and say, look, you know, let's let someone else do this now, because I've done my part and it's time for someone else to do their part. And it really took a lot of the more senior females ahead of me being stronger and standing up and then falling on to us to do the same for the junior females coming behind us. So, So it was interesting. There was, you know, when I first was in, there was a lot of sexual harassment, but we didn't have the sexual harassment rules and stuff like that they now have now. And it wasn't, I guess it wasn't talked about at the time. It was just one of those things that you just be quiet about it and don't say anything, because you would get in trouble for talking about it or for saying anything or for questioning it, instead of the other person getting in trouble for actually doing it. And different things like, you know, the typical sexual harassment situation where you have a boss who's making advances towards you and you know, putting you in a situation where you're very uncomfortable, and then your rating or your performance rating is based on that, whether you give into that or not. So that was very prevalent when I was first in.
I guess if it was such a small number of women, I mean, did that make it that much more difficult when you're talking about the 80s? And at that time, if it's a small group, then I mean, mm-hmm. you can't affect as large a change, can you?
Well, not at that time, no, because, you know, you're right, we were a very small group, and people weren't listening. We didn't have a lot of females in senior positions. You know, there were, I don't even know if there were any female admirals at the time. But as they started to get more females in senior positions and things started coming to light and, you know, more out in the public that this is wrong, you can't do this, then it started getting better. And it just took people understanding that to stand up for the fact that, you know, you're not going to get in trouble if you stand up and fight for your own rights of, you know, I'm a female, but that doesn't mean that you have to treat me any differently. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, it was as we... And it was good to have, well, I guess, I don't know if it was good to have those experiences, but you learned from those experiences and then you pass that on to the other people. And you kind of, I had senior females above me that wouldn't do anything. So I took that as, well, when I get in that position, I'm definitely going to be standing up for those people that either don't know or aren't afraid or whatever to stand up for themselves. So.
Were you ever so frustrated to the point where you were even thinking about just leaving altogether that you didn't want to put up with it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, a lot of times. I think, you know, when you're in the military, you never join the military thinking I'm going to retire in 20 years. You kind of take it day by day. And when you hit that 10-year mark, you kind of have to think, well, am I going to make this a career or am I going to get out? Because you've invested 10 years and that's a big investment. And it was even tougher because my husband was also active duty. So between the two of us, plus we had kids. And so trying to get stationed at the same locations at the same times and, you know, if one of us had to be on deployments or one of us had to be home. And so that was difficult. So a lot of the frustration between that, a lot of times would say, well, I've just, you know, had enough, I'm going to get out. But then you'd think, gosh, if I just stick it out for 10 more years, you know. And so we did. I mean, after that 10-year mark, between the 10 and 15-year mark, we kind of questioned it a lot. But then after 15 years, it seemed like, okay, we're pretty much invested at this point and it's not that much longer. So we stuck it out. And I'm glad we did. You know, we have that history and we have that, you know, those sea stories that you can always recall. And it was fun. We got to move, you know, a lot, which we enjoy. We enjoy moving. And in fact, we've been here in Sioux Falls for, I think, 6 years. And that's the longest I've ever lived anywhere. My whole life, I've never lived anywhere this long. So we kind of get the bug to, yeah, it's kind of time to move, you know. But so we bought a camper, so we go camping a lot.
Well, it has to be exciting. If you are that type of person, you want to move and you want to have that exposure to different mm-hmm. cultures and different people, it has to be pretty neat. I'm curious, when going back to how you were treated as a woman, mm-hmm. I mean, how did your husband and your dad react? I mean, did you tell them the stories and,
oh, sure.
and how did they take it in? What did they think?
Well, my husband was, you know, he was very understanding because he kind of saw it from both sides. He was a male in the Navy at the same time, and he's 10 years older than me, so he was in, I think he joined in 76, so he was in, you know, a little bit before me and kind of saw the transition of the whole females in the Navy. And so he, you know, and the fact that I was his wife, he definitely empathized with me and the situations that I was in. And, you know, he knows how I am as far as being very driven and but also a little bit naive, at least, you know, early on in my career. And that's just something that you learn, you know, with time and age. And but so he was very, you know, sympathetic, and he would, you know, try and give me advice on how to deal with it. But of course, unless you're in that situation, you don't really know. My dad, on the other hand, I don't think he to this day understands or even, I mean, I think that he understands, you know, that it's wrong, but he's just from that generation that women shouldn't be in the military. That's just his generational thought. And, you know, that's not something that's going to change. And doesn't mean that he isn't proud of the service that I've done, but he, you know, we've had many, many discussions on this issue, and I just realized that it's not going to go anywhere, so we don't talk about it anymore.
So how do you try and convince him? What do you say to him, or what do you bring up to him?
Well, he had a lot of situations where he had females that were in leadership positions above him that he didn't necessarily agree with or he had conflict with, so that was... And at that time, there were not a lot of females. So, you know, that kind of formed his judgment of, you know, how females are in the military and that they shouldn't be there and, you know, whatever. So it was very frustrating. It's very frustrating because sometimes you just cannot convince people. And even when I first went in the 80s, you know, you would talk to them and they had a certain mindset and that wasn't going to change. And you just had to learn to accept the fact that you can't change every person, but eventually, you know, the whole consciousness or whatever is going to, you know, it's going to evolve. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but it's kind of like that's how it was, because they were just so far in this mindset that, you know, women can't do this, women can't do that. And then they went to the opposite extreme. And then they went to the point where, you know, sexual harassment and fraternization became such a big issue and such a, you know, very political and very publicized. So then they went overboard with the training for the men. So when I went on board the ship that I was on, the guy, we had just, I was part of the first complement of female coming onto that ship. So they had only had males on these ships. So they got all this training about what you can and can't do. And basically they were afraid to look at you, talk to you, you know, anything. So it was just the opposite extreme. They wouldn't even if you were in a position, if they were in a leadership position and had to counsel a sailor that happened to be a female, they were afraid to do that, so they wouldn't. So then you had all these young females that were just basically like children running free with no rules, and because nobody was holding them accountable because they were just afraid to talk to them. Well, they, you know, eventually got evened out to where they realized, you know, there is a happy medium here, and so...
Yeah. And that was in the 80s, too?
That was in, the 80s and the 90s, or even in the early 90s, mid-90s, it was like that. It's just, you know, one of those uncomfortable things for people. They don't like talking about it. They don't like, and you know, you're surprised that it still happens, but it does. I mean, it still happens every day. So they just have to, I think the younger females just have to have good role models, good senior role models to show them that it's okay to say no, or it's okay to say certain things, you know, that's not right for you to be saying that to me, or I don't appreciate that, or you're making me feel uncomfortable, or whatever the case is. I think they have to feel like they have the right to express that. So
that's interesting. I'm also curious if your husband ever wanted to try, did he try and protect you at all and maybe, you know, put himself in the situation, or did he usually stay back?
Well, he, most of the sexual harassment that I encountered was before I was married. It was when I was single. I mean, not that it didn't happen, you know, after I was married, but not, it wasn't as in your face as when I was single. So, but yeah, he was definitely, he would be in a protective mode and do you want me to go take care of it for you? You want to say yes, but you know that can't happen, so. So of course, he definitely would feel very protective about it. But I think too that, most of the people that I worked with knew my husband and knew that he was in the Navy. And so in a way, you know, they respected that, and they treated me with a little more respect because of that, because they knew my husband and they knew that he was also in the Navy. And so I think that, you know, had a part of it. So.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Is there one thing that you remember the most? That, I mean, it's 20 years of your life, so that's a long time. But is there one story or fun memory that you remember, I mean, having to do with your military experience, or something quirky or strange that happened? Just something that you'd like people to know about.
Well, we were, actually, when I was with a mobile inshore undersea warfare unit, which is a unit that does... surveillance of inland waterways. And so being in supply, I basically had to get them, we would go out in the field, so we would have like field kitchens and tents and all that kind of stuff. But we were in the Caribbean, we were actually on St. Thomas Island doing some operations down there, and we had this big surveillance van that we had to stand watches on, and it was a lookout watch, so we had to stand up on top of this, it's like a big trailer, and we had on headphones and radios and stuff, and just to keep watch to see if anybody was, you know, coming or what was going on, or watching for boats or planes or, you know. So it was supposed to be, you know, they weren't supposed to know that we were there, the people on the island. And St. Thomas Island at the time, the only way to get to that island was by a boat. You couldn't fly there. You had to actually take a ferry from, it was on St. John. So we had to take a ferry from St. Thomas to St. John to get there. So it was a pretty remote island. But as I'm standing watch up there on the top of this tower, here comes a tour bus. And there's the Navy over there doing their operations. So obviously it was, you know, the word got out that we were there. And it was pretty funny. We're supposed to be all secret. And here comes the tour bus. Because we were actually doing our operations and staying at the governor of... St. John or St. Thomas, I don't remember which it was, but he had a house on that island, and that's the house that we were operating from. So But I thought that was pretty comical that, you know, we're all top secret, hush, hush, and then here comes the tour bus around the corner.
And there they are. That's great. So when you talk to people about being in the military, mm-hmm. do you find that there's an overriding misconception that's out there when it comes to, and I imagine as a woman, you get even more off the wall things than a man would.
Yeah. In fact, when I went to work at the VA, it was kind of funny because, people that didn't know me or had never met me, they thought, oh, she was in the military. You know, they have this stereotype preconception of what a woman in the military looks like, acts like, sounds like. And apparently I didn't meet that expectation. I was not the stereotypical what they had in mind. You know, they thought that I was going to be a rough and tough, knuckle dragging, you know, chain smoking. And I'm not. And it's just kind of funny that they have that, you know, mindset that women in the military are not feminine and they're not ladylike and they're not, I don't know. I come across that a lot. I mean, a lot of people think that. They just think, wow, if you were in the military, you got to be, you know, this or that. And well, not necessarily. A lot of people are in the military for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, I don't think that you can just put one label on them and say that, you know, if you were a female, then you were this or that. So I think, but yeah, even now when I talk to people and I say, yeah, I was in the Navy for 21 years, you were in the Navy? They can't believe it.
Having three sisters, of mm-hmm. course you're going to be girly because you just feed off of each other. Mm-hmm. But did they go into the military?
Oh, No, none of them did. And they were, they all stayed close to home. And I was always the one that was out and about and moving and, you know, and so it was, but one of my sisters actually ended up marrying a guy that was in the Army, so she got a little taste of it. And then my other sister, her current husband is in the Army, so she's actually preparing to move to Japan, so that will be pretty interesting because he's getting stationed over there. So but of course, you know, being around my dad and, you know, growing up in the Navy, they understood the whole thing. And every time they would come visit me, we were near the base and we would always go to the base or the ships or whatever, wherever we were. So in fact, my sister, when I made chief, when I was on the ship in Ingleside, she lived up in just north of San Antonio, Texas. And so she came down, and she used to come down a lot, but she actually got to go on the ship and when I made chief and stuff. So that was kind of fun.
Oh, sure. So now with your sisters having their own military experience, mm-hmm. are they calling you a lot, asking you questions, or maybe looking for some advice on?
Yeah. My older sister, her husband that was in the Army, she actually got really involved with the family readiness group, part of the Army, because her husband was deployed in Korea for several years unaccompanied. And so she has some experience there, but they do still call. In fact, I just talked to her last week because she said, well, can her, she's not married to him anymore, but her boyfriend now, she said, can I get him on the base? Is it okay for him to come on? And yes, you can get him on. You just have to do this or this or this. And so, yeah, that's kind of funny.
Walk through those processes. Mm-hmm. Well, do you talk to a lot of veterans too?
Well, working at the VA, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Sorry, that was a dumb question. Yeah. I'm sure you have a lot of interaction with them.
Yeah, and it's fun. I mean, I think we're seeing a big change in the population of people and veterans that we see there, obviously, with the Iraqi veterans and the younger veterans, and changing some of the ways that we do things at the VA to accommodate that. But it's still really interesting to talk to the older veterans because they have such great stories. And, you know, I just love sitting and listening to them talk. And half the time, I'm sorry, I got to go. I got to get back to work. I want to hear more, though.
And I imagine they can relate to you because you have that understanding mm-hmm. of the military.
Yeah. So that's kind of fun mm-hmm. to listen to that. So,
how concerned are you for your son's safety if he were to go to Iraq? I imagine you still pay close attention to the world affairs, being a global person yourself. Mm-hmm. And does that concern you? Do you ever want to pull him out?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when he was going through his Navy SEAL training, he broke his ankle during the training, but he didn't want to get set back in the training phase, so he didn't go to medical. And he didn't want to go because he knew that they would set him back or they would drop him from the program, and he didn't want that to happen. So he continued through the training with a broken ankle, and I would tell him, okay, you need to wrap it like, you know, I would tell him what to do, wrap it like this and put it up as much as you can. I mean, they were doing physical stuff for, you know, 14, 15 hours a day. But I said, finally I got to the point, I said, Kevin, do I need to call somebody down there and tell them that you can't do this because your mom said so?
And I can't imagine how he reacted to that.
You're no, the, mom. Yeah.
This brave man who's fighting with fighting through with a broken ankle. And his mom calls.
My son's hurt. You need to not make him do this.
And that's so, instinct. You want to protect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You still want that. I mean, I just think that, and that's never going to go away, no matter how much training he has or, whatever and how much. But I think it is more comforting knowing that he's had that good training and just knowing him. I know that he'll. And the group that they have, I mean, I think it's something that I didn't realize before until he got into the Navy SEALs, is that they're a very close-knit community. So they really look out for each other. And just knowing that, I think, gives us a little more assurance, mm-hmm. So.
And do you have any interest in reaching out to female soldiers that are still in service? And
mm-hmm. I'm actually a member of the ESGR, the state, South Dakota State ESGR, Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. So, and basically what they do is they help veterans, or they help people that are in the military, that are in the reserves, and if they're having issues or concerns with their employers, trying to help them work that out. So you get to help them out. And I think sometimes the female ones are more comfortable with a female, which, if I can help them out, then great. Then, I try and help them out as much as I can. So, yeah, definitely.
Oh, very good. I don't think I have any more questions for you, unless there's anything you wanted to add at all, or we didn't talk about any good stories you want to share.
Well, my father-in-law, his name is Henry Ford, believe it or not.
Nice.
He was in the Navy. He was in during the Korean War, and he was on, I can't remember if it was 6 or 3 different Navy ships that were sunk during the war and survived all of them. And he was on the USS Bennington, and I can't remember them all. But I should have brought a picture of him for them to take a picture of. But he's, when you look at his picture when he was in back in, the 40s or whenever it was, it looks like a picture of a sailor that you would see from a catalog or a movie or something, because he just looked like that typical, the hat cocked to the side and the sleeves rolled up and the cigarette. And, it was just a really cool picture. And he always had the best stories, and even my kids, they would sit and listen to him and just be like enthralled with his stories because the way he would tell them. But I think that, he was a big influence for my son going into the Navy too. So, but he had some really cool stories. He was a good storyteller.
Mm-hmm. Just curious what you think is your biggest accomplishment that you've had. Is there one that you feel that you point to and like, gosh, I'm so proud that I did this?
Huh. Well, I think there's several. I think the fact that I stayed married to the same person and had children and did a 20-year Navy career, and so did he at the same time. I think that's a huge accomplishment. Just, the divorce rate regularly is like 50% or something like that, but in the military it's like 80%. So it's a lot, you have a lot more different things coming at you, and it's a lot more stressful, and you have just different environments and situations that you have to work with. So I think that's probably the biggest accomplishment is, the fact that we stuck it out together and made it through.
Do you think it helped you in a way that you both were in the military?
I think so, because we could relate to each other. Mm-hmm. I could understand where he was coming from. He could understand where I was coming from. So I think the fact that we could both relate to each other definitely helped.
Thanks so much for coming and sharing. Yeah. I appreciate it.